My name is Scott Eaton. I'm an artist, kind of an independent artist and technologist. I've been an engineer and an artist kind of for a lot of years, and that path has brought me into visual effects, where I was in production for maybe 10 years and then left production. Still do a lot of consulting and training around characters and kind of the more artistic side. But 7 years ago, I kind of really got into the machine learning kind of.
So kind of before it was cool.
Way before it was cool. It was hardly cool, but it was fascinating intellectually. It was for me, getting into machine learning was like computer graphics in the early days. Uh-huh. Right when I kind of went into computer graphics, there were still unknowns and there were still things being solved, and you know, there was so much potential. And that was what machine learning was in like 2015, where we didn't know how to do it best or fastest or with good quality, but you could see that there was some little bit hint of like potential there.
So you were kind of like in this middle between tech and art. How do these two work together in your career? Because we all talk about AI as it's some kind of like a new thing that's coming and disrupting everything, and it sure is.
Yeah.
But at the same time, especially like on the ADLO, we have a lot of people who are in tech art, who are doing like environment design or anything like that. And it seems that they are always working at this line between the artistic and technological. Yep. And it's almost like very blurry. You don't really see any distinction. So how do you treat it in your work? How do you look at the art in general? Do you feel like the technology that you have available, is this more a substitute or is it more of a complement? How does it influence your work?
Yeah. So I guess my relationship to tech and computation, really, we'll just call it that, is it's kind of... it's a material, right? It's an art material. It's complicated, and you have to, at least in the context of like my use of machine learning and AI, which is super bespoke, right? I train my own data sets. I train the models. It's not any Stable Diffusion or any of the craft scale or any of the internet scale AI. It's something that's very controllable by me, where I establish the boundaries of the interaction. And so that is part of the artistic process. In as much as I kind of design the experiment visually with some anticipation of how it'll work out, understanding that the machine is going to contribute a lot, right? It'll be the assistant or the thing that does the hard work. Within the context of like content creation and, like you said, like level design and building, like the tools are complicated, right? They're digital tools. They're complicated to use. You have to be conversant in them or fluent in them to do things well. And in a lot of instances, that's a steep learning curve, and, you know, people have success because they learn the tool well and they have artistic eye or artistic intent, and that means they can do the job well, right? I think there would be a case where these technologies, AI, will make that technical requirement go to zero almost. Like, it would make it very simple to create complicated things, complex things, makes hard things easy, we'll say. And when that's the case, then the question becomes, were these artists being paid to do the technical part, or were they being paid to do the creative part, make the art? And in a lot of ways, that digital interaction is, you know, it's subject to automation, right? Because it's hard work, right? It's labor, right? And is not always the most fun, right? Interacting with these really complicated softwares. And so things that can make our lives easier, people will go all in for, and it will increase productivity. But at the same time, you know, like, we need many artists. These are the big questions that are out there right now.
So kind of talking about big questions, there is this opinion in the community where there are certain limitations to AI art, especially when it comes to something like illustration, right? So, you know, DALL-E, Midjourney, and kind
sure.
of like, and they kind of all seem to look pretty much the same, kind of like in their styles and looks. And there's not really a lot of variety. There is, obviously, but it doesn't seem to kind of show in the works that we see online. And the question that arises basically, is this even art, right? Can you even call yourself an artist when you're using this? And overall, the kind of like the attitude from the community is very negative towards these works. How do you look at these limitations? You're building your own models.
Yeah.
You're kind of like training your own thing.
Yeah.
I think this is not the case that we see very often.
Right. I mean, this is it. I existed way before I was doing this, way before, 5 years before these models came out, or these Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, DALL-E. And what they do is they just reproduce in a high fidelity with some, you know, the distribution of images that they've been trained on. And there's a lot there. Like, they've been trained on billions of images. And so there are
trillions, really, even, like, if from your talk, there's like a trillion or whatever.
Oh, those are parameters. Those are parameters in the model, slightly different than the training inputs. But for these models, you know, they have really, really rich representations inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
And often people are getting the same thing out. It's probably a failure of imagination or whatever this craft of text prompting is. And in some ways, like, you know, there's things that they can't do, which I talked about in my talk, because, you know, like, there's things that just craziest images that nobody has ever created before. It can't make them, right? Those are out of distribution. It's not able to reproduce or generate samples that are anywhere near it. But you're right, like, image making is different than art, right? So art has intention. Art has some kind of concept behind it that the artist has to imbue into the work. And just simply making an image is not making art, right? And there's a big distinction, because it looks like maybe something that somebody else made, which is art.
Yeah.
That doesn't make the thing that looks like it art. It makes it derivative and a copy, and just like the postcard of the Mona Lisa is not art. It's a reproduction of the Mona Lisa. Simple example, but the original intent is, you know, is everything, right, when it comes to art. But again, this is like gray area, because, you know, like,
yeah,
putting a boundary on what somebody would define as art varies from person to person, you know. So a really interesting aesthetic image, you know, which is well made by these image generators, does not mean it's art, just because it looks really good.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever thought modern video games should be more interesting? At The Gaming Blender, we take randomized genres, mechanics, and make a new game every episode.
I've added permadeath.
We have a survival game of a hardcore simulation, which could be House Flipper, and with the permadeath of XCOM, then that all has to be an action adventure.
Yes.
Ooh, dear.
Yes.
And sometimes it doesn't quite work.
And you have a construction off over the course of the narrative.
A construction off? The way we can do this is that we ditch your idea entirely.
Entirely.
Check out The Gaming Blender on all your favorite podcast platforms now.
Yeah, do you think, because like a lot of these fears and kind of like negative attitudes, they arise from the point where, let's say, there was an artist and he was developing this style for a very long time. He created a bunch of this work, and then comes this bot who basically trains through all of his hard work.
Yes.
And then the algorithm or the machine can just, you know, build thousands of similar, very similar images. And it does sort of require a trained eye to kind of like what you say, to see the difference between the reproductions and the original thought.
You know, like, this is the world that we're heading into, where the veracity or the authenticity of anything that's natively digital is in question, right? Like, we can't, there's not going to be an easy way to reconcile that, right? Like, literally, and it's going to be a wash. It's going to be a flood of images. There already is. And it's not going to stop. Nobody's going to turn off the tap or the faucets. So really, you have to maybe live in the real world. Like, this is my recommendation. The conclusion of my talk is that we need to situate ourselves increasingly towards the real world. If that painter who's making amazing digital paintings in that style is doing that with a brush on canvas, or can do it with a brush on canvas, do that, because AI will not do that anytime soon. But it's different. Like, we become so casual about and so accustomed to our digital workflows and our digital processes, but because they're natively digital, they're easily subsumed, or they're in danger of being reproduced as a workflow that will scale 10x, 100x, right? I need an environment. Well, here's 1,000 environments. Choose which one you like, you know, as opposed to the guy painting the environment. You know, like, these are questions, these are concerns, and I can't dispel those because it is real. Like, it's real and it's honest, but we have to react to it. And
so kind of like, you're on this side that this is a tool that you can work with. You just need to understand how to work this and what are kind of like the repercussions of using it for whatever the kind of work you do. You can be an illustrator, and you can either be on kind of like on a fence and say, hey, I'm not going to have anything to do with it. But at the same time, following your logic, that's the thing that you are opposed. It doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's going to turn off the step and these images will suddenly cease coming. Like, even with regulators coming and when maybe some legal questions are resolved and like whether it's ethical or not, like, to train these models. The fact is that there are still going to be artists who are just, they will take these technologies and they'll, you know, train whatever their own models, right? And, with their own output, and it's going to look and give different results. So the question is, should you embrace it? And I guess the answer is yes, right? Because you don't really have any other choice. It's like saying that I don't want to work with Photoshop anymore or something.
Right. But I mean, it's maybe more nuanced than that, in that, you know, it's, we have to understand what the landscape is. Like, what does it afford? Like, what does it enable with regard to process and maybe experimentation and, you know, augmenting our creativity. I don't want to use that word because I think there's, that's a double-edged sword as well. I'm worried that augmenting our creativity means the original function diminishes, right?
Yeah, kind of limiting it.
Where you become dependent, there'll be a dependency we don't continue to develop our visual imagination in the same way. But there's also a different intent and different output, whether if you work in a production environment where, you know, the only thing that matters is that thing to be done quickly and into a certain level of quality, then you're wise to adopt these tools, because if you don't, somebody else will do that to get that image done at a certain quality on the deadline. But in personal work and people's art that's divorced from any kind of economic incentive, you need to find your space artistically. And if that is on paper with pencil mm-hmm. or a pen, I promote that. I think that is an important leap that people need to be willing to make, to be like, you know what? I can just start hammering in Photoshop and control Z it until I'm happy. Or I can just go analog for a try and see what it's like to do this with my hands. Mm-hmm. Maybe for the first time, because again, you just understand which ecosystem you're living in, right? Is it just going to be up into this in competition with the million images that have been generated by Stable Diffusion and just be like one of those, right? It's what I talked about in my presentation. Like, you know, this distribution of images that these models are trained on, right? There's clusters of things that it sees all the time. And mm-hmm. is like
with the watches, for example, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what it'll make, right? It will make those things or these certain fantasy style of painting, digital paintings, right? It's consumed those by the thousands from concept art sites and whatever blog posts or wherever it scrapes them. Those are reproducible. Those become the mechanics or the ingredients for the model to reproduce. And the things that, you know, are offline, for example, you know, like you draw it on a piece of paper and you mm-hmm. take it and show it to somebody in real life, man, that's special and unique. Mm-hmm. I had this conversation with somebody last night, I think it was, like, when was the last time that you got a written letter in the post? Mm-hmm. And you think about what that actually is, right? And then that's like a vintage like thing, right? If you imagine somebody taking the time to write with a pen on paper, fold it up and put it into an envelope, put it in the thing, and somebody with their hands comes and takes it and transports it conceivably across the world, goes to your address and puts it, and you open that somewhere else. Like, that should cost like $500 to do, right? Like, that is like a super bespoke service.
Yeah.
Looking back in hindsight, like, we've progressed so far along this trajectory that's magical. You know, like that's like, wow, I can't believe that people used to do that all the time. Mm-hmm. And like, that's almost what a drawing on paper is to some people, you know?
I have a question. So how do you see kind of like AI and proceduralism work together? Because like if you take like 3-4 years ago, nobody was really talking that much about AI. There were, you know, people who were doing it, but it wasn't like the...
Yeah.
And I think, but there was a lot of proceduralism, you know, we're experimenting with those, you know, patterns or generators
sure,
or anything.
Sure.
Do you think AI is going to take that space? Do you think it's going to be like a substitute for that because it's simpler or whatever?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about that. I mean, proceduralism is just thinking about it, like it's conceivable that it's not... Well, of course, everything that's digital will be reproducible by mm-hmm. by these tools. But there's some... Okay, you could probably ask for the code for the procedural thing. And if it's been sampled, it can reproduce that. But the... You know, I really like proceduralism. And I think
that... I could tell it from your work. Because
some of it is, and I mean, it's not maybe all. It's not. I mean, there's people who are just like natively kind of. You know, that's their medium, and it's not clear. But certainly, I think there'll be a stage where you can ask for it. You can text prompt it out of one of these generators. Like there's no reason why not, except for the structure of it. Right, like some of my really kind of structured pieces. Like if I take one of those and put it in Photoshop and I do a click drag and I say generative fill, it makes an absolute mess of the inside mm-hmm. because it can't understand structure. And it's probably possibly the same reason why, totally different, but a similar analogy to why it doesn't do well at mathematics,
mm-hmm.
right? In that it's just a little bit, the neural network, the language models don't do well at mathematics, is a little bit fuzzy, as opposed to just a rigorous calculator. So potentially proceduralism is kind of safe for a while. I don't know. I can't predict.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the limitations that AI has, because I'm sure people have a lot of hopes for those limitations, at least currently. You showed a lot of those wonderful examples where you did the, I don't remember the name, how it's called, but where like you take a picture of all the stuff that...
Nulling.
What, like a plumber needs or like a billionaire, millionaire, whoever. Do you think those work well? Do you think that there's some things that the AI still doesn't see? Do you feel like it's kind of a little bit repetitive?
It is. There's... I mean, and I guess that was part of the gist of my talk as well, is that it's hallucinating some of the things that it's putting in there, and that it knows it needs to put something, but it doesn't know exactly what. So it puts some statistically probable
calculator,
like a calculator or an iPhone.
Uh-huh.
Like those typically were the things that showed up all the time. Even like,
I need to put something.
What's that?
I need to put something.
Yeah.
It might as well be
exactly. I need to null something into this mm-hmm. thing. And those would, there were lots of calculators. And the fidelity thing, again, things that have like inherent structure, like some mm-hmm. of the things like what a soldier needs or what a soldier uses. You see pistols where two handles were joined in and the barrels were fused together, right? It doesn't have a concept of structure. And it's operating purely in image space. Right, it's fusing the text prompt with the image generation, and at no point in the image generation is there any requirement that it understands the engineering of an object. Right, we kind of inherently do, but at the same time, often it's close enough where it can mimic it. Right, so for example, like you've seen countless mechs and kind of robots that AI generates because it's so well represented in the training distribution, right? Mm-hmm. There's tens of thousands of examples of people rendering out amazing kind of mechas and things that it knows how to fake it really, really well because it mimics. It's not adding kind of new knowledge in that way. Not to say that it won't, because people want it to. But there's lots of deficiencies in the image generation.
But my question is, it does have these limitations and deficiencies and kind of like drawbacks and so on, but how long will they last?
Right.
Like, do you feel like maybe in, a couple of years? Because it's like it's developing so quickly.
Yeah. No, I think, a couple of years. I mean, there was lots that I wasn't able to talk about, but we're just at the start of like... We talk about large language models
mm-hmm.
as a thing, but that's old now. Like the new thing is large multimodal models. So things that are trained not just on text like GPT-4, but text and images, or text, images, and video, text, images, video, and audio. So it all kind of conceivably understands cross domain. And so what happens when these models are trained on the corpus of YouTube? You can get a PhD from watching YouTube videos if you can learn everything that is out there in a curriculum about mm-hmm. whatever your field, mm-hmm. And so, like, these are big question marks. Like, these are big,
I kind of have, like, coming from that, and I think you highlighted it in some of your conclusions to the talk, is that fake, everything is fake. The question is, do you feel like the consumer, that us at the end, will we be able to actually differentiate between the kind of the fake and the real, between the picture and the AI?
No, I think that's the point.
So it's kind of like you won't be able to trust the content, sort of.
Right, right. And as much, well, you can hope that if you're trying to get something from a reliable source, like this is maybe where you have to trust the source. Like if you go to the New York Times
or something,
or the Guardian or something, you hope that there's an integrity to the institution that what they put on their website is fact-checked and true. Even conceivably, if GPT 4 or 5 wrote the article, that somebody read it and said that is accurate with what we think, but the internet will be awash in things that aren't. And as much as people don't read news sites anymore, and they get their news from X, Y, Z, social media site, it's so easy to spread viral information.
Yeah, and it seems like they
viral
also...
viral images as well, right?
Yeah, like, or video.
And soon video. We haven't even talked about that because that is just out of reach right now. Technologically, it's just coming in, right? Like, it's getting better, right?
So, yeah, I was very lucky to be in Boston, Harvard, and there's a professor there who was doing this whole talk about AI and kind of like it was connected more with Alibaba Financial Services and the consumer, but the effect there on those areas is tremendous.
Yeah.
So it's basically like their systems and their models, they can predict your behavior up to like, the last click or
and so on.
Sure. It is frightening in a way.
Yeah.
And I think AI in general, the biggest fear is that you no longer know what's real or not, and that the boundary is kind of blurred. And the only kind of bright spot I see is that humans, they do still they want this analog thing for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, pencil and paper or paintbrushes, and I have an example from photography, right? So with the popularity of digital cameras and Photoshop, right? Everybody jumped on that bandwagon. And now, for very weird reason, thanks to Kardashian family, people are actually buying a bunch of old film cameras.
Yeah.
And like Kodak is selling a bunch of that film, right?
Yeah.
And these people still like to do it. Like they like this feel of like the real thing.
I mean, how much better is it? Like, even if you take all your photos digitally, but you've ever printed a photo album?
Yeah, so it's like this.
Like that is a treasure, right?
Yeah,
way more valuable to anybody who comes upon it than scrolling through your thing on your phone. Totally devalued as an experience. Art the same way, like phone and or art in an Instagram feed. Like is everywhere. Like oh, good, cool, but. To encounter it in real life it activates something else about us,
yeah,
right?
It's sort of like listen to music on your phone, through earbuds, and then go into a concert.
Yeah.
These are two very different experiences.
And the conference, certainly you have an analog fidelity of the music from the concert, but you also have whatever the connection is to the performer, right? Doing it live, right? You understand person to person.
Yeah, people cry and
there's like an empathy, even
totally.
If he's just doing a great job. It's not like you're afraid or worried that he's going to make a mistake, but like he's projecting some energy to you that okay, science can't detect it, but I think everybody can say like, yeah, there's like a charisma or something that's happening or whatever a good stage performer is doing. That's totally different than just listening to audio or watching it on TV even.
Yeah, so we want to throw some rope at the end of this conversation. So art is still going to be there.
Yes.
It will change, obviously, and AI will have a big impact on that. But I think if you have a vision, if you have this urge, when do you want to write? You want to write when you just can't not.
I think one of the silver lining is that these tools are going to make creation really, really accessible. Like if you've been limited by you know, the amount of time it's going to take you to animate something. Like maybe you just define the style, and you train a network that in your style to do the in-betweens between this really interesting kind of 2D animation that you were planning to do, but you don't have to draw all the frames in between, you know, which is hard work, it's labor. And somebody does that, it's crap. But, you know, you as an individual, people as individual creators, they could be hugely empowered by the potential of some of these tools to create bigger things, right? So, and that was one of the cup half full things in my talk was, you know, like hard things will become easy, so do the next harder thing.
Mm-hmm.
That means like, you know, make the new engineering breakthrough, right? Or make the feature film that you wanted to make, but you could never get together $10 million in budget, but you have $100,000 and some really good AI tools. You've got the story. In a couple of years, you can probably make it with that, you know?
Yeah.
There's going to be different propositions.
All right. Cool.
Thanks for enjoying another episode of the 80 Level Roundtable podcast. Check out upcoming episodes on the 80 Level website at 80.lv. Join our career site at 80.lv/RFP. And share our podcast with friends and on your social networks.